Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:10 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is March 28th, and I thought we'd kick off with the dollar index, which is pulling back additionally in here today. So it does beg a big question. So we had a major appreciation of the dollar between 2021 and 22. It's now pulling back. The reason it was going up in the first place was because of interest rate hikes that were much more aggressive than just about anywhere else. So that improved the interest rate differential for the dollar. And then the fact that it was twinned with quantitative tightening and money supply growth was negative. Then what it also did was restrict the volume of dollars that were out there in the market. So that also helped to improve the outlook. So what's changed? Well, quantitative tightening is basically over. The big jump we had in the size of the balance sheet last week is a testament to that. But then we haven't yet seen interest rate cuts, but lots of other places have been raising interest rates. So since the beginning, or I guess really the end of last year, what we've really seen is not so much that the Fed has stopped raising rates, but they've started to slow down the pace with which they were raising rates, and everywhere else has been accelerating the pace with which they were raising rates. So, for example, when we look at the ECB, well, Christine Lagarde has been quite clear that they want to continue raising rates, and it's up to 3.5%. And when we think about the Fed funds rate, well, it's still rising, but not going up nearly as quickly. So they have reduced it from 50 to 25 and then another 25. Now it's still higher than it is for the euro, but that interest rate differential is narrowing. Now, what's I think especially interesting in this environment is that the Federal Reserve is saying that they're not going to be cutting interest rates and that they want to leave interest rates at a high level for as long as it takes for inflation to come back down, and that they still want to approach their 2% target for inflation. And that all sounds fine. But when we then think about what is the bond market saying, well, 10-year yields are still hovering here at 3.5%. And when we look at this longer term trend overall of the yield curve, well, it shows us that they anticipate, or the bond market anticipates, that after 6 months, we're going to see yields coming down and coming down hard. So that does not gel with what the Federal Reserve is saying. What it basically implies is that the bond market is pricing in that something big is going to break in the economy, at least in the next about 3 months, and that by the time we get 6 months out from now, interest rates will already be coming back down. And it is worth just paying attention to the fact that the 3 month yield is currently at 4.6%. So, and not yet pushing on to new high ground. It's pretty much pausing here. But obviously, the Federal Reserve is still talking about raising interest rates. So, what we have also is a reticence among investors to price in the potential for an interest rate hike before it actually transpires. So, people are definitely willing to hedge their bets. But because the dollar is coming back down, that is improving the outlook for non-US assets. So the Mexican ETF is popping here from the upper side of the base formation, and the Mexican peso has continued to strengthen. And there's a lot of different things going on in Mexico that are worth highlighting. The first is that they've signed LNG export contracts, so they're going to be exporting gas to Germany. And they're going to build their first LNG export facility, and that'll largely be funded by Germany. And then they've nationalized their lithium mines. And there is talk at the moment of building a significant solar energy generation facility. And with the express interest of supplying Baja California, but then also California and US California and Arizona with electricity. And then I think that's a good example of how Mexico is really being positioned for nearshoring. And Tesla is talking about building a factory down there. So obviously there is certainly interest. And the Mexican peso hasn't had a trend higher like this since at least 2017. But it's been a measurable improvement since the acceleration lower in 2020. Now we are approaching this 18 level, and it hasn't really traded stronger than 18 since 2016. So this could potentially be a very meaningful breakout. Now, it is just worth reminding ourselves that even in the big bull market, the Mexican peso didn't really appreciate all that much. In fact, the appreciation we've had off the accelerated low in 2020 is about the biggest appreciation that we've had in the Mexican peso historically. So it's certainly evidence of a competitive environment on a GDP front as well. And the economy is expanding at around a rate of about 4%. Now, if we stick for a moment in the Latin American sector, so the Chilean peso is also now testing a meaningful area of potential resistance, right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, we can go back and look historically, and the last time it traded below that 1,000-day moving average was in 2013. Now, as a major copper producer, the Chilean peso was one of the better performers between about 2002 and 2011, even though it did meaningfully depreciate during the credit crisis. So we've had a really lengthy decade of underperformance in the currency since the breakout in 2013. So now this is another one that is potentially on the cusp of breaking higher. And of course, that is entirely because of the relative value proposition here. Now, of course, we should also be paying attention to what happens in terms of these industrial resources. So copper prices were weaker today and coming back in to test this $4 area again. And that's also the region of the 200-day moving average. So it really ideally would need to hold that area if the benefit of the doubt is to be given to the upside. Now, oil prices were also steadier in here today. Now, we've had a breakdown from that very narrow trading range, then we've had a good sized rebound over the last week, and it is now approaching the $80 level. And I think there's a lot of moving parts in the energy sector right now. When you have Europe agreeing yesterday that they're basically going to get rid of internal combustion engines by 2035, and they've made some concessions for e-fuels, but that's a very niche portion of the market, and they can't be manufactured in a cost-effective manner. So the chances are that it's really only going to be limited to really high-performance vehicles. But oil prices are jumping on the back of that news because it means that there will be basically no investment in new supply. And that suggests that what we are being set up for is a tight environment for oil prices. Because if there's no money being invested in new supply, then in the event that demand does not collapse over the course of the next decade, there's going to be a very tight supply environment. And we could be in a higher energy price environment for the lengthy medium term as a result of that, because availability of new supply will decline and it will contribute to greater power for producers within the pricing structure. And this has been a meaningful rebound in the energy price over the next couple of days. I'm gonna hold my short position until I see it pushing up through the $80 level. But if I see that, I think I'll be encouraged to reverse it and simply go long. And when we then think about some of these energy companies, well, the energy spider has popped on the upside over the last 3 days, and it's now approaching the region of the 200-day moving average, and it is still holding the sequence of higher major reaction lows. So certainly there is a short-term oversold condition that is looking like it's being unwound right now. When we then think about what else is going on in the wider market, well, I think what's happening with the dollar is one of the more important factors. The rebound in oil is another big important factor. And I continued then to look at the cryptocurrency sector as a liquidity barometer. And when we look at Bitcoin, it was weaker in early trading and then has rebounded. It's up about $260. But the most important thing is so far it is holding this breakout and it has not dipped down through that 25,000 level. And then there was some news today about Ripple, and Ripple is popping on the upside. It is trading back above 50 cents for the first time in about 6 months. And Ripple has been very much off the radar for about 5 years. But the initial enthusiasm around it was that it was the favored token of the financial sector and that a good number of banks had banded together to support its network. Well, what we're now starting to see is that Santander in Spain has announced that they're releasing their blockchain-backed foreign exchange program. So it's active currently in 4 countries, and they anticipate speeding up the transfer of cash internationally. Now, that's about as clear a use case for the technology as one might anticipate, that it is a transfer mechanism for assets. So, speeding up foreign exchange and international transfers is, I think, one of the more obvious routes to commercialization. And Santander is also steadying now from the region of its 200-day moving average. It pulled back like everything else in the banking sector, but it is now starting to exhibit some relative strength. It has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. If it can push up through the 4 euro level, it'll complete the base formation. It's also, I think, worth reminding ourselves that Santander is, well, it was one of the original cast of the autonomies, and it's one of the truly global international banks that it generates about a third of its income from South America, about a third from Europe, and about a quarter from North America. Of course, Mexico is also part of North America in this case. And then you have a digital consumer bank, which is 10%. So it's a truly globally oriented, or I guess, should we, I think, perhaps more accurately call it a Western Hemisphere oriented bank. And there is the potential that if the Latin American area starts to outperform economically, then a company like Santander would benefit from that, despite all the other factors that are limiting for the banking sector in a tightening global economic environment. So certainly it is, I think, one to pay attention to. Then I think what we're also seeing right now is a meaningful decline in the Swedish krona. So it rebounded 3 weeks ago from the region of the low in 2020 and from back in 2008. But so far, it has not broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it was weaker again in here today. Sweden is currently enduring a significant property crash, and the banking sector has pulled back in a really dynamic manner over the last 3 weeks. And they haven't been building houses to cater to the rise in the population from a jump in immigration. and that has created not only a lack of supply, but also huge disparities in wealth and availability, and then lower standards of living overall. And the banking sector is pulling back in a significantly dynamic manner. These are massive reactions against the prevailing trend, and it suggests that it's a taste of what we might anticipate in other countries. Lots of more socialistic European countries, they basically held down the real estate price through a large rental market and rent controls for decades. And I remember just traveling around Europe in, 20 years ago, and the cost of rent in many places in Germany was at fractions of what it was in London. And that was one of the biggest enablers in the higher standard of living that the majority of people were able to enjoy. But we've had a really significant property boom in many of those countries, but most particularly in Germany and Sweden over the last decade. And that rent control safety net for many consumers has been eroded. And with the absence of building, particularly in the aftermath of the sovereign wealth crisis and exceptionally low interest rates, there's an opportunity has been missed. It's going to be more difficult to build now that interest rates are on the rise. But of course, what it also suggests is that there is a weakening economic activity. So we can't avoid the conclusion that there is a difficult environment coming up on not just a US front, but a global front. But I do think that there's the potential that it is ex-US assets are going to perform in the aftermath. And Alibaba was in strong, was up in a strong manner in here today, and they're going to split the company up. Now, what I think is also really worth highlighting is that some of the Alibaba ventures are highly profitable and others aren't. So splitting it up into six different companies is going to highlight those that do make money, like Ant Financial, and those that don't, like the food delivery services. And I think this is also very clearly going to be part of how investors look at potential going forward. And they're going to be looking at the kinds of companies that have a viable route to making money rather than spending inordinate sums to capture market share. So when we look at the really stellar performance of a company like Nvidia, it has surged higher because of the speculation that artificial intelligence is going to be the answer to every problem. But what, of course, it's also going to do is then throw greater focus onto the smaller companies that have not yet successfully been able to list. So when we then think about the SPAC index, it has not been able to rally. Significant numbers of companies are going to have difficulties raising cash because of higher interest rates and less enthusiasm from the venture sector. But then the advent of artificial intelligence, and when we hear stories like out of Stanford University that they were able to duplicate the natural learning capability of ChatGPT for only about $600. Well, that is going to really bite into the business models of a significant proportion of the venture-backed new companies. So they're now being dealt a double blow. But that is also going to weigh heavily on the speculative activity within the greater Silicon Valley environment more generally. And we continue to see that companies that rely very much on the value of commercial property remain under pressure. So Brookfield is still trending downwards. And Goldman Sachs, which basically took over the hedging books of about half of all hedge funds, is still under pressure and barely steady in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Then Amazon, which is heavily levered to the health of the consumer, is also barely, sorry, that is Amgen. Excuse me. Amazon is barely steady as it tests the region of the 200-day moving average and is still trending downwards overall. And I think it is particularly relevant here that we've had a good sized rebound by those eight exceptionally large companies relative to the entire market, but they are now starting to roll over. I do apologize because this custom chart does take time to load, but we're seeing the first evidence of some resistance coming in here. Now, it does have room in which to consolidate, and we might just see an unwinding of short-term overbought conditions. But the problem is when we look at the individual constituents, Google, for example, has paused here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And then we've had good-sized rebounds from companies like Meta. But it is now at the first area of potential resistance around the $200 level and the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I have more sympathy for a company like Meta because it's already had the big decline. Whereas a company like Apple, which is building out its advertising revenue, hasn't really pulled back all that much. And it, but it was weaker in here today. And I just think that when we look at the this chart, I'm going to post it today in Comment of the Day, but it shows how much advertising revenue has grown over the last decade within the online segment. And it now approximates all of the spending as a percentage of GDP that we had before the advent of the internet. So it does beg the question, how much larger can advertising spend grow in absolute terms? Or is all the growth in the internet going to Are the internet advertising spend going to happen at the expense of magazines, newspapers, TV, and radio? Because I think one could argue at least that a lot of that compression has already happened. So it does suggest to me at least that this wholly crowd-driven migration into advertising by these technology companies, at it's a diminishing return. That advertising was the obvious way to make money. Now every company does it. And what they really need to do is to come up with a new way of making money. Now maybe artificial intelligence is that new way, but how are they going to then be competitive? I think that's certainly something that is not yet answered. And the reality is that we have inverted yield curves. We have banks that are underperforming and high yield spreads that are rising. And all of those things point towards a recession. And I know that I've been beating this drum for a while now, but that doesn't mean that it's any less likely. It's really only a question of when does unemployment start to rise, because that would be the clear causal factor to change the trajectory of interest rates. But the dollar is already pricing in that we're at the peak of the interest rate cycle, and bond markets are already pricing in interest rate cuts. So even though we have not yet seen it in the stock market, and we haven't really seen it yet in a significant decline in corporate profits, the fixed income markets are already pricing it in. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.